admit that he had sinned and that God was right in punishing him. New King James says, because he justified himself rather than God. Is the problem here. He justified himself rather than God. As verse 3 says in the New King James, also against his three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job as he was angry with them and their inability to answer Job's arguments. Verse 4, Elihu had waited for the others to speak because they were older than he. But when he saw that they had no further reply, he spoke out angrily. Now, some of you remember the old television program, The Lone Ranger. Some of you may even remember the radio broadcast of The Lone Ranger. Do you remember the question that was asked many times at the end of the program? Someone would turn away as he is riding off on Silver, and someone would ask, who was that masked man? Now, one is tempted to ask the same thing about this guy right here. Who is this guy? Elihu. Well, we don't know actually where he comes from. It is believed that he is the author of the book itself. Elihu means the God of him. The God of him. Or my God is he. My God is he. He is the son of Barakel. Barakel means God blesses. God blesses. He's the Buzzite. The word Buzzite means contempt, disrespect, shame. It's as if his last name was Hitler or Bin Laden. Now, in the opening of the book, it states that Job lived in the land of Uz. But there was another land nearby called Buz. Buz. These lands were named for two brothers back during the days of Noah after the flood. Uz and Buz. Elihu came from the land of Buz. A Buzzite was considered contemptible. And that's probably how Elihu was considered. This young whippersnapper, contemptible. It also mentions the term ram. Ram. Which means exalted. Exalted. I do not know if God intended all of these names to have some significant meaning. There is a possible message in the names. When Elihu rose to speak, those who were listening to him, the three friends and Job and whoever else might have been around, would have heard a message from the background of this man. Elihu, the God of him, and in this instance, a reference to Job, the God of Job, son of Barakel, has blessed the Buzzite, the one you held in contempt, and Ram, he shall be exalted. Putting these terms together, it would be a message possibly to Job's three friends. The God of Job has blessed the one you held in contempt, he shall be exalted. I don't know if that's the case or not. It's interesting, though, to look at these names. Elihu waits to speak because he assumes that the three friends who were much older would impart wisdom to Job. He is greatly disappointed. Now, their combined ages could very well be over 300-400 years. We're talking about at the time frame of Abraham, where they live 100, 200, 300 years. So they have been around for many, many years. They should have had an answer, but they didn't. And it shows that age is no guarantee of wisdom. Is no guarantee of wisdom. It is not necessarily true that the older you get, the wiser you become. It is assumed. What? You think I was born yesterday? You ain't dry behind the ears yet, sonny. I've been around the block a time or two. I've been through the school of hard knocks. What's wrong with this generation today? They just don't have any respect. I just can't understand it. Just pitiful, pitiful, pitiful. Well, hey, it's true. At times, we will find too many in the younger generation are disrespectful, are discourteous toward their elderly. We no longer see where they're using respectful terms like yes, sir, or yes, ma'am. There was an article back in the 80s when kids called Grandma Mags. And Grandma is even encouraging the grandchildren to refer to her as Mags. We lose that sense of respect, unfortunately. Whereas the Bible says you should rise before the gray-headed. And respect should indeed be shown. As we age, we can look at that. There's a piece that read many years ago. You may have heard of it, a father's image. At 4 years, the boy said, "My dad can do anything." At 7 years of age, "My dad knows a lot, a whole lot." At 9 years, "My dad does not know quite everything." At 12, "Dad just doesn't understand." At 14, "Dad is hopelessly old-fashioned." At 21, "Dad is out of date." At 25, "He knows a little bit about it. He's okay." At 30, "I wonder what Dad thinks about this." At 35, "Before we decide, we'll get Dad's idea first." At 50, "What would Dad have thought about that?" At 60, "My dad knew literally everything." And at 65, "I wish I could talk it over with Dad once more." But there's no guarantee that as we age, we will gain wisdom. That should be the case. It's the person who is able to analyze his life, who can understand about the mistakes that he has made, can learn from those mistakes, reduce his life to principles to be able to pass those down to the succeeding generation. That's all the book of Proverbs is. These are principles, short, pithy sayings of the author to the next generation. And that's what we need to be able to do for the next generation. To learn from mistakes and pass those down as principles to the next generation. Well, continuing here in chapter 32, verse 6, it says, "Elihu, son of Barakel, the Buzite, said, 'I am young and you are old. So I held back and did not dare to tell you what I think. I thought those who are older should speak, for wisdom comes with age. Rather, as the Living Bible says, it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty, which makes him intelligent.'" Verse 9, "But sometimes the elders are not wise. Sometimes the aged do not understand justice. So listen to me and let me express my opinion." I'm sure that would have gotten their attention, this young whippersnapper coming along here and telling them that just because you guys are 100, 200 years old, that doesn't mean a thing. You think you're wise, you don't know squat. And so I'm sure that probably got their attention. And person who was young and dumb can grow up to be old and dumb if they haven't learned. Paul had to chastise some in the book of Hebrews because they were old, they were aged, they were old enough and experienced enough to be teachers, but they had to be taught once again the first principles of the oracles of God. After a while, God expects something to be laid on us spiritually. Not that we have to keep on going over 1 + 1 = 2 year after year after year after year. There needs to be an element of maturity and growth in all of us, because if we're not teaching now, we will be teaching in the world tomorrow. Verse 11, I have waited all this time, listening very carefully to your arguments, listening to you grope for words. I have listened, but not one of you has refuted Job or answered his arguments. And don't tell me he is too wise for us. Only God can convince him. Verse 14, if Job had been arguing with me, I would have answered with that kind of logic. You sit there baffled with no further response. Should I continue to wait? Now that you are silent, must I also remain silent? He had to speak. He was not going to use their logic to get across his point, but he had to speak. Verse 17, he says, no, I will say my piece. I will speak my mind. I surely will. For I am pent up and full of words, and the spirit within me urges me on. The man is so full of words that he speaks for 5 chapters more. Again, who is this young man, this whippersnapper who speaks before God does? He is just winding and winding. The whole chapter 32 is just talking about, I'm so full of it, I got to say something. And I'm sure that these three friends probably wanted to say something. He wouldn't let them speak. Shut up. I have something to say and I'm going to say it. You had your turn, now I am. Now, that's not respectful, but hey, he let them know. We move into chapter 33. Listen, Job, to what I have to say. Now that I have begun to speak, let me continue. I speak with all sincerity. I speak the truth. For the Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me if you can. Make your case and take your stand. Now, he took the whole chapter to say he was full of words, still winding up to throw the first pitch like Satchel Paige back in the day. And he never throws it. He just keeps on. He challenges Job now to answer his argument, but he doesn't even give Job a chance to answer. Verse 8. You have said in my hearing, I have heard your word, very words. You said, I am pure. I am innocent. I have not sinned. God is picking a quarrel with me, and he considers me to be his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches every move I make. In this you are not right, and I will show you why. As you yourself have said, God is greater than any person, or as King James says, any man. God is greater, and this is his specific purpose. God is greater. This is what we must always remember about God. He is greater. He is beyond us. His understanding is much greater than ours. It is indeed unsearchable. He has raised the charge, Job has, that God has been unjustly persecuting him. And God needs to be put on trial. Further, God doesn't answer those in need. Elihu will deal with these allegations. He handles them in reverse order. Verses 14 to 30, he deals with the second. Verse 14, for God speaks in one way and in two, though people do not perceive it. as it says it in the New Revised Standard Version. Once again, one of the major problems we have with unanswered prayer is the silence of God. We say our prayers are not answered because we have prayed and we have prayed and we have prayed and the answer has not come. And we think that God is responsible to answer us day before yesterday. Answer us immediately and answer us in the way we want. The way we want. Elihu helps us understand that God speaks in ways sometimes we don't even understand. We're not even aware of them. He brings out a couple of these ways. The first one through dreams, verse 15. He speaks in dreams, in visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on people as they lie in bed. He whispers in their ear and terrifies them with his warning. He causes them to change their minds. He keeps them from pride. He keeps them from the grave, from crossing over the river of death. Elihu says that God's purpose is to stop man from destroying himself. It is man who is bent on his own destruction. That is our minds. It is a carnal mind. It is a mind of Satan. It is bent on destroying itself. That is Satan's mind. God warns us to keep us from hurting ourselves and each other. One of the ways he does this, according to Elihu, is by dreams. Now, before we attribute all dreams to God, because there is that tendency, hold it here. Go with me over to Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 3. Where is it the individual who does not dream? And it will not be wise to attribute all dreams to God. He can if he so chooses. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 verse 3. For a dream comes through much activity. Through much activity, dreams come. I referenced before my beloved grandmother. When we were growing up down in Opa-locka, she played the numbers. She dutifully read Farmer's Almanac to help her come up with numbers. But the thing that always intrigued me, she would get one of these mason jars, pour some water in it, put it underneath the bed at night to help her to dream the number. And in the morning, she would then call me Hampy, go and play number 7. You know what? Number 7 came out about as often as number 7 did not come out. Didn't help her one way or another, but it didn't stop her. She continued to put that bottle of water underneath the bed to help her to dream. Dreams come from a multitude of thoughts and not necessarily from God. He can. God speaks to us today. How? Through this book. Through the Bible. Hebrews 1:1-2 brings that point out. At various times and in various methods, God has spoken. He spoke through Urim and Thummim. He spoke through dreams and visions. He spoke through a donkey. Nothing can inhibit him. But he expects us now to learn from him, to listen to him through this word. Prayer is my communicating to God. Studying the Bible is God's communicating to me. That's primarily how he is doing that today. It is important for me to study. But then the second point that Elihu brings out on how God speaks, it is through sickness and pain. Through sickness and pain. Verse 19, or God disciplines people with sickness and pain, with ceaseless aching in their bones. They lose their appetite and do not care for even the most delicious food. They waste away to skin and bones. They are at death's door. The angels of death wait for them. Elihu is probably describing all that Job has gone through and is going through. And he is saying, God is speaking to you, Job. You think that he isn't saying anything? Believe me, Job, he is. Your very suffering is God speaking to you. But it is not so much what your friends are saying because of some sin that you have committed. That isn't the case. God is helping you to understand something you don't understand, and pain makes it possible. It is hard when we are sick. It is hard when we are pained to think in terms, well, God is saying something to me through this sickness, because all I want is to be rid of the pain. It's not a matter of me listening. What is it you're trying to say to me here? No. God, you've made the promise to heal, and he has. Now get rid of this pain. And the pain doesn't go. Why? According to Elihu, God is speaking. God's saying something. We know people who are healed immediately, instantaneously. We have been. And then there are times when we are like Paul. I have besought God several times, and this thing won't go away, because God was speaking to him. My grace, Paul, is sufficient. It's sufficient for you now. God was speaking. There is a statement in verse 24 of Job 33. It mentions about a ransom. Back here in Job chapter 33. See, I'm not going through the entirety of it, but in Job 33, verse 24, then he is gracious to him and says, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. This is most likely a reference to Jesus Christ, one of these Old Testament references to Jesus Christ. We move into Job chapter 34. Job chapter 34, verse 5. For Job has said, I am innocent, but God has taken away my rights. That is Job's first problem with God. He says, I haven't done anything wrong. God has punished me unfairly. I have obeyed, so I should be blessed. We've gone through that time and time again. Verse 6, I am innocent, but they call me a liar. That is what the friends have called him. You are lying, Job. You're a hypocrite. You've actually committed some great and egregious sin. Continuing in verse 6, my suffering is incurable, even though I have not sinned. So Elihu says, verse 7, has there ever been a man as arrogant as Job? Now, last time we talked about Job's problem. The assumption has been that he is self-righteous. When we look at the definition of self-righteousness, it's comparing yourself to someone else in your favor, that you are morally superior. Job doesn't do that. But Job does something worse. Job's comparing himself to God. And here is Elihu saying and describing him, has there ever been a man as arrogant as Job with his thirst for irreverent talk? He seeks the companionship of evil people. He spends his time with wicked men. He has even said, why waste time trying to please God? Back in chapter 1 of Job, as we read it, Job made the comment, the Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, as Elihu says, he has the same attitude as the wicked. Because his attitude now is, what advantage is for me to do anything that is right? Might as well go on and sin. Satan is working on his mind. When you find yourself in a prolonged trial, and there just does not seem to be any end in sight, beware. Lurking behind the door is Satan. He is succeeding in working on Job's mind. Verse 10. Listen to me, you who have understanding. Everyone knows that God doesn't sin. The Almighty can do no wrong. He repays people according to their deeds. He treats people according to their ways. There is no truer statement than this. God will not do wrong. The Almighty cannot twist justice. Excellent point, Elihu. God can do no wrong, period. That is a starting point that must be an ending point. God can do no wrong. If we say that God treats us unfairly, then we are saying God is denying his very nature, his very character. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above, comes down to us from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variableness. There is no shadow of turning. He can do no wrong. Period. Verse 13. Who put the world in his care? Who has set the whole world in place? If God were to take back his spirit and withdraw his breath, all life would cease and humanity would turn again to dust. Another very insightful comment from this young man. Again, hold it here. Go with me to Colossians chapter 1. Colossians chapter 1. It's been rare that I've turned away from the book of Job. But for a little break's sake, I'll turn this time. Colossians 1, 16 to 17. Paul says, for by him all things were created, speaking of Christ, all things were created that are in heaven, that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. Verse 17, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist or have their being. The wicked person who says in effect to God, leave me alone, I don't need you. I don't want you in my life. What if God did that? If God removed every bit of himself from our lives, we'd just collapse. We would just collapse. God gives us the very breath of air that we breathe. Our ability to function as human beings comes to us from God. The person now who challenges God is challenging God with the very life God gave him. As my cousin's grandmother, Grandma Pinky, used to say, "You stupid thing." And that is us as human beings when we challenge God. God can do no wrong. He is God. I am man. I am man. Continuing on back in Job, verse 16 of chapter 34. Job chapter 34, 16. Listen now. And try to understand. Could God govern if he hated justice? Are you going to condemn the Almighty Judge? For he says to kings and nobles, "You are wicked and unjust." He doesn't care how great a person may be. He doesn't pay any attention to the rich man or rich than he does the poor. He made them all. In a moment, they die. At midnight, they all pass away. The mighty are removed without human hand. Like he was saying, how can a man be more just than God? It's very easy to see these days that if man wants to inquire into the justice of something, first thing he has a tendency to do is appoint an investigating committee. That's in this country. And if we have a committee, we have to get some funds for that committee. The committee then goes and sets up an office, hires secretaries, hires staff. A couple of years later, after quote-unquote labor, they come to some conclusion. By that time, they find out somebody in the committee has been corrupt and may have been bribed or corrupted. So they have to appoint another committee to investigate the committee that has just been set up. And it just goes on and on. Elihu says, God doesn't do that. God doesn't do that. Verse 21, for God carefully watches the way people live. He sees everything they do. We don't. Even with our own children, it's part of the reason why we have the blessing of little children ceremony, because we can't watch our kids 24/7. God sees everything. God sees everything. In marriage, when there are problems, even in marriage, God sees everything. He sees everything. No darkness is thick enough to hide the wicked from his eyes. For it is not up to mortals to decide when to come before God in judgment. He brings the mighty to ruin without asking anyone, and he sets up others in their places. You note the contrast? As we were reading Job's comments last time, Job is saying, God, where are you? Come on down here. Let's go to court. Who do you think you are, God? I haven't done anything wrong. I've searched and I've searched. I've done nothing wrong. The focus is on Job. Elihu comes along. The focus is on God. It's on God. God doesn't need to hold a trial in order to condemn us. We are not innocent until proven guilty before God. God knows we're all guilty until we are made innocent by coming under the blood of Jesus Christ. God sees everything, even our thoughts. Our thoughts from afar off. I can hide from my wife. I can hide from my children. I can hide from other human beings. I can't hide from God. Verse 25. He watches what they do. And in the night, he overturns them, destroying them. He openly strikes them down for their wickedness, for they turn aside from following him. They have no respect for any of his ways. How hard it is for us to learn that the only way we can properly live life is to include God. Is to include God. It has to begin with him. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding. He's got everything, the whole world in his hands. So anything else really doesn't matter. Going on, verse 31, it says, why don't people say to God, I have sinned, but I will sin no more? Or I don't know what evil I have done. Tell me and I will stop at once. Must God tailor his justice to your demands? But you have rejected him. The choice is yours, not mine. Go ahead, share your wisdom with us. Will he, according to the Revised English Bible, will he at these words condone your rejection of him? It is for you, Job, to decide, not me, but what can you answer? What he is saying is that somebody may say, well, all right, I've got into trouble. I did something wrong. And I won't do it anymore. I'll change my life. I'll watch myself in that area. Got a drinking problem. I'll watch myself in that particular area. Elihu says, who are you talking to? You're talking to yourself. You're not understanding about God. The greatness of this being, God. That partial change that we now kind of drum up in ourselves. Yeah, I got a drinking problem and I'm going to watch it. You know, I know I shouldn't be. I might have one too many. I mean, I can put away about 2 6-packs, but, you know, hey, I'll just cut it down to 1 6-pack. Who's talking? That's self-speak. I'm talking to me, right? I'm not including God. Verse 34, after all, bright people will tell you, and wise people will hear me say, Job speaks without knowledge. His words lack insight. Job, you deserve the maximum penalty for the wicked way you have talked. For now you have added rebellion and blasphemy against God to your other sins. Boy, oh boy. I don't know what Elihu and Zophar and Bildad are thinking at this. I mean, he is laying into this man. All right. You have committed blasphemy against God. Now, God said, as we have read it over and again, the man was righteous. Something happened to him. He does indeed sin. He does come face to face with God and he melts. But he is speaking some very arrogant words about God. And Elihu say, you are bordering on blasphemy, man. Be careful what you say. We move through the final three chapters quickly. Chapter 35, verse 1. Elihu said, do you think it is right for you to claim I am righteous before God? Yet you also ask, what's the use of living a righteous life? How will it benefit me? God is unjust. I might as well go out and live like the wicked people. Why in the world do I keep myself clean? Verse 4, I will answer you and all your friends too. look up into the sky and see the clouds high above you. That is, you can't do anything about them. Can you? They are up there floating along. You can't even reach them. We can today, but back then at that time, you can't even reach them. He says it's like that with God, verse 6. If you sin, what do you accomplish against God? Even if you sin again and again, what effect will it have on him? If you are good, is this some great gift to him? What could you possibly give him? No, your sins affect only people like yourself. And your good deeds affect only other people. Another insightful point. God is independent of what we do. Whether we obey him or disobey him, it does not change God. It does not change him. Our sins hurt ourselves and others, but they don't change God. Doesn't mean that he's not concerned. He is. He loves the world, and he wants us all to be saved. He is concerned about what we do. But we don't help God by obeying him, and we don't hinder him by disobeying. He's not up there biting his fingernails because we have done something wrong. Oh, no. Son, did you see what he did? Oh, no, that hurts me. He's God. He's God. He's here. Job, understand something. You better get down here. And he will be here shortly. Verse 9, the oppressed cry out beneath the wrongs that are done to them. They groan beneath the power of the mighty. Yet they don't ask, where is God my creator? The one who gives songs in the night. The music that can comfort a soul that is in despair. Verse 11, where is the one who makes us wiser than the animals and the birds? In the midst of all of this, if we were to ask God, show me. He responds. As we talked about initially, the question we have so often is, why me? Why? As opposed to, show me. Verse 12, and if they do cry out and God does not answer, it is because of their pride. Why is God silent so often? So many times we cry for help. God knows that what we are crying for is relief. We want the harmful, painful effects of our selfish ways just to end, and so that we might possibly go back to doing what we were doing in the first place. It's a funny thing, human beings and the human mind. I watched the demise of my mother due to Alzheimer's, and she became the shell of the person that I grew up with in this very state. We had her in Maryland with us for a short time before I put her in assisted living and then migrated to the nursing home. My mother loved to look good. She had jewelry. She spent a considerable amount of money on. There was one ring that she loved to put on her finger. But once she got it on her finger, she couldn't get it off. And in her Alzheimer's state, she comes to me complaining about the pain of that ring. I try to pull this ring off and can't get it. I then soap it down and can't get it. In the meantime, she's screaming. And after minutes of working with this, I get the ring off of her finger. In her own way, she's saying thank you. And what does she do? She put the ring back on her finger. Something was wrong with her mind. Something was wrong. That's what happens to us with sin. Sin is pleasurable. It's painful, but it's pleasurable. And as we sin, we want the painful effect to be eliminated. Once it's eliminated, you know what? God, can I go on back there and do the same thing all over again? That's craziness. That's why this human mind of ours is insane. Who's concerned about what God wants and being taught by God what He wants? We, for the most part, are crying out for deliverance. Remember what James said. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence from your own lusts? He says, you ask, you do not receive, because you ask amiss, to consume it on your own lusts. I'm concerned about the pain. I'm only interested in getting rid of the pain. And I am speaking personally. And I'm praying, and I pray personally. I want the pain to end. I'm trying to do the right thing here. I want the pain to end. I'm not interested in what you got to say here, God. I want the pain to end. Our selfish ways has presented us with this pain, and we fail to understand a very important point about Beatitude number one. On this man will I look, to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit and trembles at my word. That's Beatitude number one. That's where Job will be brought. That he now will be humbled before his God. And when he is, God answers so that he understands. In chapter 36, now, verse 1, Elihu continues speaking, let me go on, and I will show you the truth of what I am saying, for I have not finished defending God. I will give you many illustrations of righteousness of my Creator. That is the place to start in our own human reasoning. God is right. Therefore, any deviation from that is not right. God is good. Any deviation from that is not good. As he is trying to get this across, not only to Job, but to all of us. Verse 4, I am telling you the honest truth, for I am a man of well-rounded knowledge, or as New King James says, perfect in knowledge. Some commentators believe he is referring to himself that he was an arrogant young man. We want you to understand a bit about this book and what he is saying. We read it in another context, chapter 37, verse 6. Actually, what he is saying, God is perfect in knowledge. And when I understand that perfect knowledge of God, then I am well-rounded. Then I am well-rounded. Verses 5 to 15, he says that God is both merciful and just. God may be trying to get our attention by some pain or adverse circumstance that we may be going through. And he's opening our ears, and he wants us to listen. Then Elihu describes Job's perilous condition. Verse 16, he says, God has led you away from danger, giving you freedom. You have prospered in a wide and pleasant valley. God has blessed you, Job, in the past. Verse 17, but you are too obsessed with judgment on the godless. Don't worry, justice will be upheld. You're preoccupied with justice. as though that was the ground on which you should stand, even before God. Justice will be upheld. Verse 18, but watch out, or you may be seduced by wealth. Don't let yourself be bribed into sin. When you find yourself in a certain frame of mind, you become susceptible to sin. Interesting when you see your mate may be getting away with bloody murder. That gives me license to do something wrong, doesn't it? New King James says of verse 18, because there is wrath, beware lest we take or he take you away with one blow, for a large ransom would not help you avoid it. Job is bitter. When bitterness sets in, what can God do? That spirit surfaces at times in a problem marriage, bitterness. The heart no longer is attuned to God. I've seen it. Oh, how I have seen it over and over and over again. And you can say God speaks to you through this Bible, but when bitterness is reigning, I can't hear it. I cannot hear a word you say because of the bitterness. And so we are on the borderline of unpardonable sin. That's unfortunately where Job is moving. If God did not step in, this righteous man who started off righteously could have been consigned to the lake of fire. But God uses Elihu as preparation, and then God is about to slap him. Then he concludes the section by warning Job. Verse 19, it says, could all your wealth and might of mighty efforts keep you from distress? Do not long for the cover of night, for that is when people will be destroyed. Be on guard. Turn back from evil, for it was to prevent you from getting into a life of evil that God sent this suffering. Then he says, God is beyond men's instructions, verses 22 to 25. Next, God is beyond men's understanding, verses 26 to 29. Finally, God's actions are beyond human comprehension. He uses his power to bless and punish, verses 30 to 33. And then we come to chapter 37. In the beginning of chapter 37, there's the description of a great thunderstorm. Many commentators feel actually began at this very moment. I tend to concur because of chapter 38. God has allowed Elihu to speak. Now here comes God. The thunderstorm is about to speak. But before he does, Elihu, who is full of words, gets his final words in. Chapter 37, verse 1. My heart pounds as I think of this. It leaps into me. Listen carefully to the thunder of God's voice as it rolls from his mouth. It rolls across the heavens, and his lightning flashes out in every direction. Then comes the roaring of the thunder, the tremendous voice of his majesty. He does not restrain the thunder when he speaks. God's voice is glorious in thunder. We cannot comprehend the greatness of his power. We live in a state that can rock your very feet. For when God thunders here, your house shakes. The ground shakes. And he hasn't even started speaking. Then Elihu speaks about how God sends the snow, the rain, the wind, the frost. He controls the weather. Verses 6 to 12. Verse 13. He causes things to happen on earth, either as a punishment or as a sign of his unfailing love. God has many reasons for doing things. We're not always certain why and what they are. And then he talks about God's wondrous works in verses 14 to 20. Verse 14, listen, Job, stop and consider the wonderful miracles of God. Do you know how God controls the storm and causes the lightning to flash forth from its clouds, his clouds? Do you understand how he balances the clouds with wonderful perfection and skill? When you are sweltering in your clothes and the south wind dies down and everything is gone, he makes the skies reflect the heat like a giant mirror. Can you do that? You think you know so much, so teach the rest of us what to say to God. We are too ignorant to make our own arguments. Should God be told that I want to speak, can we speak when we are confused? What can you say to God? The arrogance. Again, I've brought this out before. We encounter this next time when we are confronted with God. Studying science, you can see the arrogance at times in teachers because they're so brilliant. So brilliant. And yet a simple question. The simple question as we in physics class studying Coulomb forces. And the student asks, why do we have Coulomb forces? And the response by the professor, the doctor, we don't deal with why. We just deal with how it works. We leave the why to metaphysicists. Wow. Then he concludes with the majestic splendor of God, verse 21 to 24. We cannot look at the sun, for it shines brightly in the sky when the wind clears away the clouds. Golden splendor comes from the mountain of God. He is clothed in dazzling splendor. We cannot imagine the power of the Almighty, yet he is so just and merciful that he does not oppress us. No wonder people everywhere fear him. People who are truly wise show him reverence. Throughout the Bible, those who get a response from God are the ones who come with a humble spirit and a contrite heart. They come with the attitude, show me, not why me. They come with the attitude of teach me, not what are you doing. Elihu has given Job an excellent introduction about respect for God because the very next voice Job hears in the account is the voice of God himself. And God just sucks the very spirit right out of this man. And that's what happens when you come face to face with God. As we'll look at it, the final message in the future.